This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, I'm really excited today because I'm going to talk to somebody that I really, really love and admire. He makes me laugh so much. I did one of his shows once and I just giggled through the whole thing. He's a very smart, lovely man, and his name is Harry Hill. Harry Hill, how are you?
Hello, Twiggy. I'm very well, yes.
Oh, it's so lovely to see you.
Well, when did we first meet? I was trying to think today when we first met.
We first met, I think, on your when you very sweetly invited me to come on your tea with Harry Hill show. And I did rewatch it last week. And
I mean, really?
It was bonkers.
Well, that was the most.
You made me pierce. You were making a molecule. You made me pierce tomatoes with a breadstick and an egg.
That's right. Yeah, of all the shows, I mean, it's the least well-known show I ever did. I did that show for Sky.
And
I don't know. Maybe people don't watch Sky as much as they watch other. But it was the most fun out of all the shows I've ever done, you know, even though people perhaps don't know about it. That was Tea Time thing, which basically, if you haven't seen, it was a spoof cookery show, wasn't it?
It was hysterical.
All the recipes were inedible.
Good for a cooking show.
And then it ended up with a food fight at the end, didn't it?
It did. I think I managed to duck out of most of that.
Yes.
You did, as you just said to me, you did wear the most gorgeous Sergeant Pepper jacket.
Yeah.
Do you remember? It was bright blue.
Yeah, it was Beatles. What was it? Beatles cookies or something, wasn't it?
I can't remember. It's only. Yeah. It was half an hour of madness, but great fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. It was always fun. And then at the very end, we would launch a 20-foot-long inflatable sausage into the audience. Which the first time we did it, we had too much helium in it, and it went up and got. Stuck on the lights, it burnt on the so we just had to keep using the same footage every week.
That is so funny.
Yeah.
So how have you been? So I think that was about 2017.
It's a long time ago, isn't it? Where does the time go, Twiggy?
I know. Where does it go?
How have I been? Well, we had a thing called, there was a pandemic. I don't know if you heard about it.
I know, I was going to ask you about it. How did you cope?
Well, we were talking about it yesterday. I mean, we're very lucky here here at home, because, you know, we've got a garden and the weather was lovely. Yeah. And there's an enormously expensive delicatessen around the corner, which we would go round and buy a piece of cheese for £8. And it was actually, you know, I've got quite fond memories of that first lockdown, you know, when the weather was nice and it was scary, but because it was sort of unknown, you didn't know what was saying. Every afternoon at 5 o'clock, you'd be glued to the TV seeing what, you know, Mr. Boris Johnson had to say.
Oh, God.
Let's not get into that.
But no, I know what you mean. I mean, we were lucky, like you. We just actually exchanged contracts on a place in Sussex. So we had lots of Sussex.
That was Sussex.
Put my teeth back in. And so we had lots of boxes to unpack. We had things to do. And then I got asked if I'd do this podcast, which was wonderful, actually. I mean, I was a bit nervous because I'd never done one. And then I did. I think I rang Joanna Lumley up first because I know her, and I thought, well, she's great fun and she'll tell wonderful stories. And
she's a great booking. If you've got Joanna Lumley's number, you don't really need anyone else's number.
That's very true, and she's gorgeous, and I love her to bits. And I said to her, look, I'm ringing you because I'm really scared. Will you help me through my first podcast? She said, of course, darling. And of course she did. Bless her heart.
I mean, for comedian, it was tough because, you know, we couldn't, you know, it's the one thing you need for a comedian is an audience.
Yeah.
So it was that weird thing, you know, and I hadn't stopped doing gigs. You know, it was the longest period I'd ever had without doing a gig. Nor, you know, normally a couple of weeks perhaps. But
and then you're
just
on the road, are you, doing stand-up?
You know, you're on the road, you're doing clubs, you're just sort of, you know, if I had a gap between other stuff, I would just go and do a, you know, just to sort of top up the joke catalogue, and then you couldn't do them. And then, but there were these online gigs, you know, when it first started.
That's right.
You know, we forget how much this technology has advanced. And you do that. So I did a few of those. And the first few you did, you couldn't hear the audience. You couldn't see the audience and you couldn't hear them. You know, this, the technology improved. Yeah. So you do the joke and you wouldn't even really.
Silence.
You wouldn't even know if anyone was actually out there listening. And then that improved, you know, and then you could see a few people, you know, in their front rooms. But then you'd be doing the gig and you'd see someone get up and make a cup of tea or something. It was like, it's not what you really
not
what you want.
Very good for your confidence, is it?
No. And then I got asked to do, I didn't do it, but I got asked to do, they started doing drive-in. Did you hear about this? Drive-in
no, what's
gigs.
That?
Yeah, so the idea was someone had a bright idea, you know, the sort of height of the pandemic, that you could drive into a field and the comedian would be on a stage. Right, so you'd go on and you'd do it to a bunch of people in cars.
Like a drive-in movie.
Like a drive-in movie.
Oh,
and
wow.
The bloke booking it said to me, oh, yeah, you know, what'll happen is they'll get out of their cars, they'll be sitting at picnic tables, but, you know, and they'll be laughing. But the truth of it was, and I didn't do one, but I talked to Bill Bailey.
Oh,
He did one. And he said, basically, because we're British, you know, once you're in your car, you don't want to get out of your car. So they sat in their cars and instead of laughing, they honked their horns. He said it was like doing a gig to a bunch of people waiting to get on a cross-channel ferry.
That's so hysterical. I mean, that's mad. That's like a sketch, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was weird. It was weird for me. And it was like the first time I'd stopped, you know, kind of working.
But surely
really.
The upside, I mean, You've got three girls, have you?
Yeah.
How old are they?
Kids. One is just sort of, so you've got 25, 24 and 18. So
oh, okay.
The 18-year-old, who weirdly, Twiggy, is a massive Twiggy fan.
Oh, how sweet.
I say weirdly, I'm joking. But yeah, she's, I would beckon her in, but she's probably still in bed.
End, get her to come and say hello.
She did a screen print of you.
Oh,
she did
oh,
a screen
fabulous.
Print of you.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
So she would have been, 15, 14 when COVID, yeah. So were the other girls at home as well?
No, as soon as they heard that they might have to stay with us for an indefinite period, they headed off to the coast. We've got a holiday home. We've got a holiday home.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes,
really.
They headed off down there. So they had a great time because they were on the furlough.
Oh, great.
They were on the furlough. As in, we were lucky because we, you know, we didn't get it. We didn't get ill or anything. I mean, I didn't get it until till the whole thing had settled down.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't. I mean, we were both quite nervous at the beginning, like you said. And also, you know, my...
If you were over 50...
Well, Lee and I were way up there. So, you know, it was scary, wasn't it? Because we didn't really know. And you know, and some people, you know, really, really suffered and lost loved ones, and it was absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
But actually, yeah. We, like you, we got it much later, but I'd had all my jabs and things, so.
That's it, the jabs. Once you got the jab, you know. But it was just that weird. It was that weird. I mean, I imagine it's what it was like where, I mean, it's in a different way, but, you know, when there was a war, that feeling of not knowing what was going to happen.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure we'll all be talking about it. You know, like my mum, who's in her 80s, she talks about the war the whole time, having lived through it. And I'm sure when we were in our 80s, we'll be going, yes, I remember
the COVID. But did you?
I remember Codiv.
Now you write, as well as being, you know, a performer, you write. So wasn't that a good time to sit down and?
Well, like all comedians,
pen to paper.
Yeah, like all comedians during the lockdown, what I did was I wrote my autobiography.
Oh, brilliant!
The thing, it was brilliant, except that every Christmas, every comedian had
an
autobiography.
Book out.
You know, you either wrote an autobiography or you wrote a play or you wrote, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I'm quite happy to be at home in some ways. You know, I can sort of amuse myself and, you know, you can still write jokes and sketches and stuff. So.
And you can perform.
And in fact, I carried on doing, I did that, you know, I do Junior Bake Off, which is like the kind of kids' version Bake Off, and that actually still went ahead.
Much fun. That must be so much fun.
When it's mixed bag, Twiggy. I mean, it looks it looks like a lot of fun, and it is a lot of fun because kids are obviously endlessly surprising. You know, I mean, that's what's so fun about it. But at the same time, you know, they do get quite upset.
If they don't win, yes. They like to
or if
be
they
the
don't big. Win, or if they just, you know, like if a grown-up drops their cake onto the carpet, you know, they might be able to just sort of think, right, I'm going to, but, a little one, they do tend to cry. And of course, we edit all that out.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's lots of wasps and there's a lot of sugar. So 90% of the time I'm going like that, swatting away wasps.
Have you got your cup of tea as you're having tea with me? What do you drink tea? Oh, that's a big cup.
Well, it's because I'm holding it close to the camera. Look, it's even bigger.
Oh, yeah, mine's bigger too. What are you drinking?
Well, I like, you know, I like just breakfast tea.
Builders.
PG Tips Gold is what
Gold.
I like.
Gold, okay.
In our family, I have milk, right? But in our family, with the kids and my wife, they all have, there's like three different milks.
Oat,
you know, there's one
takes
soy, oat, you know, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous,
yeah,
Twiggy.
I'm milk, I have to say. Yeah. Now, I mean, I knew this from meeting you, but I don't know how many people listening do know that, but you trained as a doctor, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh, that was another thing that happened.
What?
That during the pandemic.
You went in and became a doctor again.
Well, you laugh, but you know what happened was
what?
That I kept on the register, you know, to stay on the medical register, all you have to do is pay a sub every year.
Oh, okay.
And because I hadn't done it for a long time, I was registered as retired, and I used to just stay on the register out of nostalgia, and I thought, well, you know, why not? I just kept paying it basically. It was on one of those direct debits you can never find, work out how to cancel. And then I got contacted, right? You remember the early days of the pandemic when there was this, you know, they built that Nightingale Hospital and it was all sort of doom and gloom. And they contacted me saying, as a retired doctor, we want to talk to you about returning to work, right? Yeah, I know. And this, bearing in mind, it's 30 years since I gave it up in 1990.
And were you actually fully qualified then?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay,
I worked for sort of 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Then another 18 months sort of part-time. And so I'd had a few drinks and I clicked on the link and signed up to be returned to right? Yeah. Next day, of course, I wake up and I think, oh, God, what have I done? Nothing happened, right, for a couple of weeks. I thought, oh, you know, I've got away with it. And then I get this phone call. I get this phone call from Dawn of the London Workforce Hub wanting to talk to me about my return to work, okay?
I was
really nervous. You can imagine, right?
Oh, my God.
And she's saying to me, so what did you used to do? I said, well, you know, I was a general physician. She said, so what sort of thing? I said, I don't know, you know, respiratory. Oh, right. And she's writing all this down. And I'm saying, look, I haven't done it for 30 years. She said, no, it's not a problem. Anyway, at the end of this call, she said to me, could you start work on Monday?
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, well, yeah, I mean, not possibly sort of thing. And then they sent me all these tutorials to get back up to speed. So I clicked on the first one. It took me about an hour and a half just to do this one. I thought it's going to take me 5 years to get back up to speed. And then luckily, you know, with the vaccinations and everyone washing their hands and, you know, behaving themselves, they never followed it up. So I think it would have been very worrying if you woke up and you saw me at the end of your bed.
It might have
cheered.
Then
you know you're in trouble.
Might have cheered people up. But
yeah.
Called you, would you have had to go in?
Well, that was what I was worried about.
I mean, legally.
I felt like I was being called up. You know, it was like, yeah. I thought there's going to be a car arrive and two blokes are going to get out and
get
bundle
you in the
me
car.
Into the back of it. But no, is the truth. And actually, I phoned up my, you know, I've got a lot of friends who are doctors, obviously, and I phoned them up and they were just laughing at the idea of me.
I bet that is, it is hysterical. I think there's a TV show in that, Harry.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
There is. I'm sure.
I felt really nervous. It's funny because, you know, and I remembered why I gave it up, is that I didn't ever feel really comfortable as a doctor. I never felt really in control. You know, people say to you, do you get nervous going on as a comedian? And I get a bit nervous, but nowhere near as nervous as when I used to be on call.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because people's lives are in your hand, or?
Yeah, it's the responsibility. Yeah. And I just don't think I was cut out for it, honestly, you know?
I mean, it is a
perhaps
big leap from doctor to comedian, isn't it? I mean, yeah. were you always funny? not funny peculiar, but funny.
Depends
hard.
Who you ask. Depends who you ask. I always loved comedy. You know, like some people follow music as a teenager. I loved comedians, you know. So, I mean, as a kid, I mean, in the 70s, it was the TV was the only, you know, I grew up in rural Kent, so it was your kind of only window on the world. The only way of finding out what was going on was to watch TV. You know, you couldn't Google stuff. And so, you know, I used to love all those, you know, Walk on Wise, Tommy Cooper, Bruce Forsyth, all that lot. And then, you know, Spike Milligan and Monty Python. And so, yeah, that was the stuff I really, that really affected me.
Did you have one life? I mean, I think Tommy Cooper was my all-time. I mean, I love Morecambe and Wise, but Tommy Cooper.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as he walked out, you start laughing, and he hasn't done anything.
Yeah, I never saw him. Yeah, I never saw him live. I mean,
no,
I was never.
I'm just on TV. No.
Yeah, it's a shame we never.
He had funny bones, but you have funny bones too.
but he's exceptional because it's not really about his material, is it? Actually, because a lot of his jokes told by anyone else would be
they're not funny.
Terrible. I mean, but it's just the way he.
He would walk out in that TV show. He did. He'd walk out through those curtains. And he was so big, wasn't he? And he'd just stand there with that
fez
on and that face. And you'd be hysterical. I mean, I would be hysterical. And he hadn't done anything.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
So, yeah, that was the thing, really. I just liked. But I couldn't work out how to be a comedian. That was the thing.
So did you one day think, I'm not going to go to work tomorrow? I mean, how did it kind of...
Well, what it was... happen? Because I came to medical school in London around that time, sort of in the 80s, that was just the start of that alternative, so-called alternative stuff, you know, so the comedy store. There were loads of clubs in London, comedy clubs that, sprung up. So I would go to those just for a night out. And so I'd see people like, I don't know, Joe Brand and Lee Evans and Jack D, people like that. And I realized that you could, that it didn't seem such a difficult thing to be in the audience in a pub and then be on stage in the pub. You know, it wasn't like the London Palladium, you know, or it seemed like it was a bit a kind of like an underground sort of scene. And so if a weird thing about medical school is there is this tradition of medical school reviews, sketch. Yeah. So I was heavily involved in those. So I, you know, and gradually it was just one of those things. And I was wrestling with it, basically about, I knew I wasn't happy being a doctor, but I had, obviously it's such a huge thing to step away from. Difficult to say to your mum, oh, you know, I'm a doctor. Because it was just giving it up. I was so busy as a doctor, I couldn't do it part time. I couldn't do any, you know, I was working, you know, back then the doctor's hours were a lot longer. You know, I'd be, I would start, I'd be on call for a weekend. I would start on Friday morning and I wouldn't finish till Monday evening.
Oh my goodness. No sleep.
Yeah. Well, you'd be on call, so you'd go to bed, but then you get woken up.
You don't get proper.
Well, sometimes you would, but you'd usually go around about midnight, make sure everyone was okay, and then you'd probably get woken up at about 2. You know, people have heart attacks in the early morning, or they have asthma attacks, and that was the thing. So I used to be on the cardiac arrest team, so it would be I'd be in bed, and it would go dee 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 dee, and then fall out of bed and then run across the car park.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, you got to be the right sort of person for that, really.
No, listen, thank God for doctors.
Thank God for doctors. I know.
They were the heroes of the pandemic. Well, always. Now, you did live in, I read in your bio, you lived in Hong Kong for a couple of years, right?
Yeah, as a kid. Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, it was mad. I mean,
I visited once a long time ago.
Yeah. So this is 1978. I was living in a small village in Kent, right?
Uh-huh.
So then, you know, you had to get a bus to get to Maidstone, which was like the center of the world. You know, they had a cinema and a W.H. Smith's and a Sainsbury's. And then suddenly we were in Hong Kong. It was just crazy, you know. Just a completely different culture.
Yeah, I bet you missed your friends because you were a teenager.
Yeah,
weren't
yeah,
you?
I didn't like it. You know, when I first got there, I was really lonely and unhappy. You know, but then when we left, which is about 2 years later, I didn't really want to come back because it was I'd got the hang of it by then. Yeah. You know, life was really exciting.
Was that because your dad's or your mum's work? You went.
Yeah, my dad's job. I don't really know what he did to this day. something to do with shipping. He used to get on the train in the morning and disappear and then come back in the evening.
Not a spy.
Well, he might have been a spy. Might have been a spy, Twiggy.
Ooh.
How would I find out?
Ooh.
I mean, he used to have a gun. No, he didn't. He didn't have a gun.
Hi everyone, I hope you're all well. I'm really excited because I am going to be doing my first live show as part of the London Podcast Festival in King's Cross, London on Saturday the 16th of September at 7 p.m. And I have the most wonderful special guest who's going to join me and have a chat and have tea with me. And that is the wonderful, the hilarious, the divine Ben Elton. So if you'd like to come and join us and join in the fun, please go to kingsplace.co.uk and type in Tea with Twiggy to book your tickets. See you there. Bye. Now, I saw you on telly a couple of weeks ago talking about this musical, which is
Oh, yeah.
Going great guns.
Tony Blair, the musical.
It sounds absolutely hysterical.
If you're in Sussex, it's going to Brighton, I think.
When?
I think Brighton's probably the nearest. Do you know, I can't remember. A couple of weeks, I think.
I'll look it up.
So, Tony Blair, the musical. I'll tell you about it. Basically, it's a good story for a musical, I think, because it's extreme. You know, Tony Blair, whatever you think of him, he started off as a sort of peace-loving hippie. You see even those photographs of him at Oxford with the long hair.
Yeah.
Because he was a very young prime minister. He was one of the youngest prime ministers he ever had at the time.
Yeah,
and he turns up and he's sort of young and he's got that grin and he's sort of, I mean, he's not, I wouldn't call him necessarily handsome, but he's compared to John Major, you know. Which was the other alternative.
Although you know, when my daughter Carly was a little girl, she had a crush on John Major.
Really?
But she was only about 7. She thought he was a nice man. But then she also loved Sid James.
Right. Nice to have a type. Yeah, and then he becomes, you know, Britain's most successful Labour Prime Minister. And, yeah, you know, that time was in Britain was a really exciting time. It was Britpop and it was the turn of, you know, it was the millennium. It was the, you know, it felt like, you know, compared to now, like a very hopeful time, I think, to a lot of people. And it was suddenly kind of trendy to be British again. And then obviously the whole thing goes very badly wrong with the whole, you got 9/11 and the whole war in Iraq, which turned everyone against him. And so it's like a kind of rise and fall in many ways. And somehow we've managed to make it funny.
And have you written all the songs?
So I don't write the songs. I wrote it with Steve Brown, who's a friend of mine who he writes musicals basically and writes funny songs and stuff. Yeah. And the songs are brilliant.
So you did the script and he did the...
We did it. We sort of did it together to an extent, but, you know, we would... So I would say, oh, how about a song about... I mean, and some of it's a tricky stuff to work with because of obviously the nature of the material. And so Saddam Hussein, right, obviously he's not a funny person, but we play him as like kind of Groucho Marx. He's got the moustache and the eyebrows and the cigar and he's saying. And so, you know, we were kind of came up with this idea of basically he's singing a song saying, you know, what I never did anything wrong. You know, because that was his line basically. In the around that, he was saying, "Bessie, I haven't got anything. I've not done anything. Why are you picking on me?" And then it lists all the terrible things he's done. And he says, "Well, yeah, I never done anything wrong." And he sings it as a kind of Groucho Marx. We would get together, and I mean, the writing it was brilliant fun. I mean, it took a long time to get it off the ground. Obviously, we were about to sort of workshop it, and the pandemic happened. So
I was going to say that it must have clashed with that. So yeah. What, did you just, like, so many projects, it got put on hold, yeah?
It did, yeah. And then the problem went after the pandemic was that all the projects that had been put on hold were suddenly back on and you had got this huge backlog. So it was very difficult to get venues and...
That's right, I know.
Yeah, so, and, you know, a lot of venues, I think, closed down.
We had so many friends who were in that position, just, like, waiting in the queue. You know, directors, actors, musicians.
And everyone wrote a blooming play. That's the other problem. While they were locked up. There's like a huge backlog of material. But, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, this show.
Did you ever think you'd be in it or not?
I wanted to be in it. But Steve said I didn't have a good enough singing voice.
He didn't, did he?
He did, yeah. What a swine. What an absolute swine.
Who did you want to play?
Well, the main character is, in a way, is the kind of ringmaster of it all, is Peter Mandelson. So he comes on the start. Yeah, it's a bit like, you know, it's not really like Cabaret, but, you know, in Cabaret you have the sort of ringmaster. Mm. Or actually the better reference would be the Rocky Horror Show, you know, with Tim Curry as the kind of...
Yeah, lovely Tim.
So, he's brilliant, isn't he?
Brilliant.
Tim Curry is brilliant in that. in that show.
Yeah, it's one of the great performances.
It is. It really is.
Did you see that live? I saw that live. He was.
No, I didn't. I saw it live, but not with him.
He was unbelievable, mesmerizing, larger
so
than
charismatic.
Life. So charismatic. That voice, and he was.
What had he done before that? I mean, what was his sort of thing?
I can't remember. Gosh, I mean, I think he was quite young. I think he was just, you know, a young actor, and it was like, you know, they often say that there's always one part that changes an actor's life, and that certainly was, I think, for him.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's also such a, I mean, I know him a little, but I haven't seen him for years because he lives in LA. But he's a lovely, lovely guy.
It's good to know.
So
I didn't have a good enough voice.
Oh, you poor thing. Has Tony Blair seen it? Do you know?
We always put two tickets on the door for him, Twiggy. But he hasn't claimed them.
With TB on the front.
Yeah, Tony's tickets. So if your name happened to be Tony Blair, even if you weren't,
you get free ticket.
You'd get in free. Oh. No, he hasn't been. And someone said to me, someone who did know him briefly, said he wouldn't find it very funny, but Cherie might.
Oh,
apparently,
okay.
Cherie's got a bit more of a sense of humour about it. Although Cherie in our production, we play as a sort of cross between Lily Savage and Cilla Black.
Oh, you know,
she's that kind of, she's a kind of scouser, you know.
I'm so impressed that you've done it. It's amazing. I mean,
yeah, I'm quite impressed that I've done it actually. Because it is quite a big job getting anything off the ground.
Oh, it's so hard.
Without you know, it's easier if you're in it. You know what I mean? If you say, it's a Harry Hill thing, but it's much harder to persuade people because basically that's what you're doing, persuading people to back it.
I know.
So, it's a lot of fun. And it's going all around. I think it's going to Birmingham this week and Cardiff and Brighton and Edinburgh. It's going to the Edinburgh Festival for
a month. Fabulous.
So that would be good. I think I'd do well there.
Are the cast loving it? It must be so
You know what?
Fun.
They are. And it's a very cheap production. You know, it's because there's nine of them playing all these different characters.
Oh, how fabulous.
So there's a lot of changing wigs and, you know, the main problem we had when it first opened was that Saddam Hussein's moustache kept falling off. So now it's on elastic. It's on elastic.
All around the back of the head.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the only way to get it to stay on. So you get an idea of the kind of production value.
I wanted to ask you, because you were doing stand-up, right? You went from being a doctor, doing stand-up, and then suddenly you were on telly. I mean, how did the telly thing happen? Did somebody see you in a club? Because suddenly you were on telly and all over everything, and, you know, we all fell in love with Harry Hill and his madness.
Well, what it was, I think, I got a job. I was in Edinburgh. I did a two-hander with Alistair McGowan. You know Who was a really good friend, and he had done a lot of radio because he did voices. You know, and a producer from radio came to see him and saw me at the same time and gave me a job writing for radio. So I started writing on a weekly radio show. Then I got a radio show of my own called Fruit Corner, Harry Hill's Fruit Corner, which was basically a kind of radio version of that Badger Parade Channel 4 show thing.
Okay.
And then I tried to get it on TV. No one would have it. And then just, you know, sometimes it just takes something suddenly happens. And there was like a stand-up show called Saturday Live on ITV. Lee Hurst hosted it. It was a live thing.
Okay.
What was good about that was that they couldn't edit me. So I had my 5 minutes and I could go on and just do my thing. And that really gave me, suddenly that they were all over me, the TV people. You know, it just happens like that, doesn't it?
Yeah,
they all decide at once, right, we want him. And then it didn't really matter what I wanted to do at that point.
And then when one wants you, then the other one wants you.
At that time. And then and off I went on that crazy show, with Bert Kwok.
But you won, like, loads of BAFTAs, didn't you?
Not for anything for that. I got comedy awards for that. But then the TV Burt was the thing that really... So I did the Channel 4 thing, and that was like a kind of cult thing, I think. It was like a... You know, Channel 4 in those days was a bit more of a sort of cult channel, mm-hmm. wasn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And then they didn't want... They sort of said, oh, yeah, we've had enough of that. And then ITV took me on... I did, then TV Burt was the big sort of success, really, yeah. of
Is that
kind
what
of mainstream.
You got the, what did you get the first BAFTA for?
I got BAFTAs. Yeah, I got that's what I got the BAFTAs for. Yeah, for TV Burt.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I got... I certainly didn't win any BAFTAs for the other one. And rightly so.
But even, I mean, to have one BAFTA is wonderful. You've got, how many have you got?
Yeah,
three. And then the comedy awards.
Yeah, I got various comedy awards, but that was easier to get because it was, you're just against comedians. Yeah, it's a lower bar.
Oh, whereas the BAFTA is up against lots of different.
Well, yeah. You know, I don't know. It's the BAFTAs are the ones that people.
Is it true you do a comic strip ? Somebody said, "Oh, I think he did a comic strip in a."
It was a comic strip in the Dandy.
In the Dandy. Oh God, yeah. That takes me back. Is it still around, the Dandy?
It's not. I think it's online now. But yeah, when TV Burt was on, they had a strip in it which was Harry Hill's Adventures in TV Land. Which was very thrilling. Yeah, I've got all the copies.
Did
in
you
the loft.
Write it and somebody drew it?
Someone else wrote it and drew it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
but
and they used to send me two copies of it, and one of which I'd give to my youngest daughter. The other one I keep.
Fabulous.
Had a free gift on it.
I grew up on the Beano and Dandy, and also the girls' magazines were Judy and. Oh, God, I can't remember. It's so long ago.
Jackie.
Oh, God. Yeah. Mm. Amazing.
Yeah, I was a Whizzer and Chips boy.
Was that a magazine?
Whizzer and Chips comic, yeah. The first thing I ever had printed was a cartoon in Whizzer and Chips. I got a 50p postal order.
Wow. As a kid?
Yeah.
That must have been so exciting.
Yeah, but the thing was, in those days... So I only got the Whizzer and Chips when I had the money to buy it, right?
Uh-huh.
So by the time I got the letter through saying we're printing it, it had already come out and I'd missed it. So yeah, I never actually saw it in print.
You never?
But I was very pleased with the postal order.
I bet.
Cashed that at the post office.
Oh, you didn't keep it.
No, it was a lot of money back then, 50p.
When did you, I love the clothes, I love your big shirt collar.
Oh, yeah.
You haven't got one on now, I must tell you. But when
not
those,
today.
Do you have those made? Those big
You have to, shirts? You for some reason, and you're a fashion icon. For some reason,
I think you're
can't
a bit of
them.
A fashion icon.
You can't buy them in the shops for some reason. I don't understand.
Why? You should do a line of Harry Hill shirts.
Yeah.
With those big collars, they're brilliant. Did you go to a costumier?
Yeah, so there used to be a lot of people around, or you know, a lot of tailors that would make that kind of stuff. You know, showbiz, light entertainment, and there's fewer and fewer. And actually, the guy that made them, Mr. Domitakis, and a lot of them are sort of Greek Cypriots.
Yeah.
He retired.
He was very old.
He was very old, and the last time I saw him, actually. For a fitting, I took his pulse because he didn't look very well.
Oh gosh,
he didn't look very well. But actually, he's retired. So then I had to find. I just found there's a brilliant bloke. I found Gary down in Kent, who is brilliant.
And he
because
still
the problem with them is, yeah, they can make them, but they have to make them stiff enough to stand up.
Stand up.
Particularly if you get on stage and you get a bit hot, and they start to sort of wilt, and you end up. It sort of falls down your back like a sailor. Yeah, so I'm very fussy about it.
But what gave you the idea to do a shirt? Was it your idea? Was it?
Well, it's just that I had a shirt with a big collar. You know, I used to buy all my clothes from Oxfam. You know, from charity shops in the 80s,
90s. Well, now that's a big thing now. It's all...
Yeah, and so the stuff you could buy back then, that was stuff from the 70s. You know, if you're in the 90s, you know, now if you're buying them, probably it's stuff from the, I don't know, 2000s. But I had this big collar and I used to wear it just because I liked it. But people used to say, oh, that's really good. That's funny, that collar. And so... So I kept, you know, I kept wearing it, and then when I had a bit of money, I got some made, you know, with bigger collars. It's just that thing of, you know, in showbiz, if it works, keep it in, you know. And it's a funny thing; people go on about it, but really, it wasn't a big plan or anything. It's just a happy accident.
But it works, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I did think. I mean, around that time, a lot of comics were casual. You know, they would be jeans and a T-shirt. And,
that's right.
And I always thought, because I was a fan of the sort of, you know, those old comics, I always thought, oh, no, you should put a kind of an outfit on to go, yeah.
Yeah, because actually Morecambe and Wise were quite smart, weren't they?
Yeah.
They always had a suit on.
They all had suits, yeah. They all wore a suit. Even, you know, Tommy Cooper had a suit. It was the fez that was the kind of undermined it. But so I always thought that. My kind of references were always that sort of slightly cheesy entertainment, musical sort of seaside specialty type stuff, you know.
Are you in the middle of, are you going to do more TV shows, or are you in the middle of shooting any, or?
I've just made and it sounds ridiculous. I've just made a silent film about a caveman twig. I'm editing it at the moment.
Oh.
In which I am this is an idea I had just before lockdown, which I was stopped from doing by lockdown. And the idea was a live show about, I thought if you could come up with a live show where there was no dialogue, that it could be a really interesting idea. So I started doing this live show where I was a caveman. I came on as a caveman. I don't think I've got the wig. Well, anyway, but it's like, I've got like a Max Wall wig, you know, like that long hair. And a caveman fur and these fake rubber feet. Okay, so I booked a venue and I went on. I had this rock, cardboard rock that I'd made, and I came out from behind the rock. I got these fake teeth. And the audience just looked at me like I was completely mad.
And, I think you are.
And it didn't get much better. It didn't get much better. By the end, they were looking at me like, when's this going to stop? So I got a few laughs, but then, so I rewrote it and did it again. And that got lots of laughs. But then that was literally the Friday before the lockdown. And so that was.
And you didn't speak through the whole thing?
No. It was lots of music and sound effects and stuff.
Oh, amazing.
Being, you know, falling over and being hit with rocks and stuff. And so then when the lockdown eased off a bit, when you could go out, I got a cameraman and we went and filmed some bits. I found a cave.
Because every caveman needs a cave.
Every caveman. Where is a caveman without his cave? And just down from Margate, I was walking along the coast. You know, we used to go on those long walks, you know, and I found this cave. I thought, oh, yeah, that would. So I filmed a bit just for fun. And then I thought, oh, no, this is something I really want to do. So I've just, I'm not sure how long this thing's going to be. I think it might be about 50 minutes. You know, it's quite long for a silent thing.
So it's, I don't know what I'll do with it.
Yeah, I don't know what I'll do with it. But, you know, I'm kind of at that stage where I just want to do things for fun, really, or things that I enjoy. So,
I mean, I think, in life you get to that point, don't you?
Yeah.
I think, when you've done lots of different things, you suddenly think, I always decided, well, many years ago, that I only wanted to work with nice people. Because life's too short, you know. Luckily, I've been really lucky. Most of the people I've worked with have been fabulous. But there's
most people are, though, aren't they?
Remember, they are.
Yeah.
But
what was,
know,
Ken,
I mean,
Russell like? What was Ken Russell like?
Well, he changed my life, really, because,
I know,
you know,
yeah.
I was happy. You know, I was 18 years old when I met him.
Yeah.
Happy modeling, doing very well. And he changed. I mean, I always think of him as my mentor, really, because he kind of.
Really?
Well, he introduced me to, he used to have film nights, him and his wife, Shirley.
Right.
Both of them not with us anymore, sadly. But And he would show all these amazing European films and Eisenstein films and all the Fred and Ginger movies. And it was like, oh, it was like, and play me classical. I mean, my dad was a musician. He played, he self-taught himself piano, but he liked the big bands. I didn't really ever grow up on classical music, and Ken loved classic. So I, it was kind of like a meeting this wonderful teacher, really. And then when he cast me in The Boyfriend, I was very nervous. But I had this, to me, this master, you know, giving me this chance. So I think, and he was low, and he was very funny.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, I'm not sure you'd get someone like Ken Russell today. You know,
I don't
that
think
kind
you
of, you know, that experimental.
I mean, he was very eccentric. Mm. And as he said, people either love my work or hate it. He said, all I don't want is people to fall asleep. He said, I don't mind if they throw things at the screen.
Yeah, I feel the same. I always think I'd much rather see something. I'd much rather have a reaction to it than just sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And that was Ken. And, you know, and he did go too far in lots of his food.
Yeah.
It was when he went into his fantasy mode.
Yeah, sure.
And Shirley would kind of say, Ken, you can't, you know, it's going on to 20 minutes is too long. But, you know, some of his greatest work he did for TV, you know, all the composers and for Omnibus, I think.
Yeah, Pop Goes the Easel, that the black and white thing about the pop artists.
Yeah, well, he did, and he did many composers and dancers, and they were amazing. They were groundbreaking for television. Mm. So I just feel very lucky that our paths crossed, and he opened a whole world to me of performing. So I was lucky.
Yeah, cool.
But do you have one person in your life that kind of...
Oh, not a what? As a mentor?
Yeah,
do I? I don't think so.
Sometimes it's a teacher, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I had... there was one teacher at school who basically really kind of encouraged me when most teachers, and about you, were discouraging. You know, it was slightly... I don't know, it's a funny thing about teachers, isn't it? You sort of... It's a shame not all of them could be a bit more go for it.
Yeah, I was lucky because I love school actually, and when that happened to me, I didn't plan to leave, but I had teacher. I either loved them, or that I was frightened of them. Because I grew up in the 50s, so there were a few teachers then that were still quite strict.
Yeah, there were those teachers that everyone was scared of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if
that
still
happens.
I
never got the cane or anything, although that's, I think they were still giving it then.
Yeah, they were still giving the cane when I was at school.
And Lee, my husband, he got the cane, or the wax, they used to call it. Mm. Must have been horrible.
Yeah, but I think he probably deserved it.
He probably did. Listen, it's been an absolute joy talking to you.
Good to see you.
I could chatter on for hours, but I know you've got to go. So if people want to go and see Tony Blair, the rock opera, how do they find out where it's on?
Yeah, the best thing to do would be to Google Tony Blair rock opera, basically, and there's a whole list of dates. But off the top of my head, as I say, Birmingham this week and Brighton and... Cardiff, and we're actually doing they're playing Sedgefield Parish Hall. You know, Sedgefield was his first he was the MP for Sedgefield.
Oh, Jenny really?
So we're doing two gigs there. I think that's sold out, but I'm not sure they have a box office there. I think you have to pay cash.
Well, good luck with the rest of the run.
Thank you, Twiggy.
And I hope our paths cross again soon.
Yes, absolutely.
Lovely to talk to you. Lots of love.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'm sorry I made so much noise laughing, but Harry is really funny as well as being really lovely. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And please check out Tony Blair, the rock opera. I'm going to go and see it. It sounds amazing. And if you Google it, you can find out, because it's going all around the country. As Harry said, it's in Brighton and Birmingham and the Edinburgh Festival, and many, many other places. So do look it up. And I hope you enjoyed the chat as much as I did and had a little giggle with me. Bye, see you soon. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.